Hey friends, welcome back to Eco Chic, a podcast all about practical science and sustainability. Really happy to have you back this week, and if you are new to Eco Chic, I'm really happy that you're here with us. My name is Laura Diaz, and I am a graduate student studying climate science. I'm actually going to be graduating with my master's in a couple weeks, and I'm pretty excited about that. This podcast is a fun place to share things like general climate change education or personal sustainability efforts, things that are not necessarily common knowledge, but totally should be. Every week, we're coming at you with information about climate change and just how to be a more responsible citizen of the planet. I'm really excited this week on Eco Chic to be coming at you with a conversation between myself and Nicole Walker. Nicole is the author of Sustainability, A Love Story. In Sustainability, A Love Story, Nicole questions what it means to live sustainably while also still having things like internet access and eating bacon. She talks about the catch-22s of life when you want to live sustainably but also want to go to Costco. Nicole is a really funny author and honestly a great person to just sit down and chat with. I'm so glad that I got to meet her. Nicole actually teaches at Northern Arizona University, where I am getting my degree, and she is also the author of 6 additional books. She is a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts, a notable essay in Best American 2008, 2014, 2015, 2016, and nonfiction winner of the Best of the Net 2013 and 2014. She's a really, really great person, and I think that she brings a lot of interesting insight to the conversation of sustainability because I feel like she comes from a really honest angle. Most of us are not living this totally zero-waste lifestyle, this totally vegan lifestyle, where we're doing as much as we can to put as little impact on the planet as we can, but we're also just trying to be as conscious as possible. And I'm really excited for y'all to hear Nicole's take just on the subject of sustainability as a whole, what it means to her, and what we should all be doing. And she brings up the idea of a personal cap and trade program, which I really, really like. If you've been listening to Eco Chic for a little while, I'm always a really big advocate for just doing what works for you. You don't have to always accomplish all of the tasks on your list to be a sustainable person. So it's just really awesome to see someone else advocating for it from a different angle than my own. And with that, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Nicole Walker. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to Eco Chic. I'm so excited to just like be hanging out with you today and finally get to meet you in person.
Hi, Laura. It's so great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So before we get started, I was hoping that you could introduce yourself to the audience and introduce your new book, Sustainability, A Love Story.
Sure. My name is Nicole Walker, and I teach at Northern Arizona University. I'm a professor there, and this is my latest book is Sustainability, A Love Story. And the idea behind the book is how are we going to get it to save the get it together to save the planet, since we have such a hard time getting it together to save ourselves, to save our marriages, to save our kids, to get even, you know, the smallest, like, groceries bought seems like an ordeal some days. And I feel like there's a connection between that desperate feeling like we cannot do anything to save the planet, that corresponds in a lot of ways to that desperate feeling that we cannot get it all done. And so I write this from this point of view of, you know, a white middle-class woman who's dealing with the daily issues that come up, trying to think more globally about what the effects of our individual choices have.
I'm really glad that you bring up the idea of us also being worried about, like, this rat race of, like, taking care of your kids and buying groceries and whatever it is. And I think for that reason, sustainability feels like a huge task for a lot of people. It's just intimidating to think about climate change and to think about, like, it's just so easy to feel guilty for getting a reusable bag at the grocery store, whatever it might be. So I think that just drawing that parallel between being worried about the planet but also just being worried about your entire life in a developed country like the U.S. is just so easy to... It's just easy to, like, fall behind on it. You know what I mean?
It's totally true. And you feel like we come from this environment where we are meant to feel guilty about everything. You know, it's a Protestant work ethic. It's, you know, Catholicism. It's Jewish guilt. You know, it's all of this guilt that I think pervades our moral culture that, you know, is the thing that I guess in some ways drives us, right? But on the other hand, when you keep adding more and more things to feel guilty about, you know, driving your car to the grocery store or, you know, forgetting your reusable bags or going accidentally, oh my gosh, buy, you know, a single-use plastic cup at Starbucks. And you just say, I can't keep up. But on the other hand, I feel like there are ways to assuage that guilt or to maybe make some headway by paying attention to those little things. So I wonder if thinking differently about our relationship to those small things, as opposed to feeling guilt, to have it either be part of our habits, so it's not, you don't have to feel guilty, or you reward yourself when you do a good job of, you know, bringing your recycled bags and reusable bags and your reusable cup to Starbucks.
I think that's a really good, the idea of rewarding yourself is a really good kind of acknowledgement, I guess would be the word, because I also was recently reading something about the term, I want to say what's called ethical narcissism is what this research paper called it. And like when you do something good, you feel like you have to tell the world that you remembered your reusable bag or you have this metal straw or whatever it might be. And you feel like you have to kind of like show off that you're being a good person. And why is it that we feel that way? Totally. Why is it that we feel like because I'm not conforming to this idea of like single-use plastics, like you said, that you're somehow like a better human and a better environmentalist or whatever it might be. And I was hoping that, like, on that subject, we could kind of talk about these, like, catch-22 things that we don't necessarily always think about. Like, I really liked the idea of coffee that you brought up in the book, or air travel, or whatever it might be. Like, what are some really easy things that we kind of gloss over in our society when it comes to sustainability?
Do you know what I've been thinking a lot about, along these lines of you know, the littlest things that we do, like people idle their cars. I have this whole chapter in here. It's called Judgy McJudgerson. And it's about, I walk by these people and they're driving this gigantic Cadillac Escalade and it's just sitting in the parking lot. And I keep walking by them and I do this weird, like, turning with my hands to signal, turn off your car, turn off your car. And obviously I look like an insane person. And I feel like that this is such a small thing, right? Just yeah. Don't idle your car. What an easy switch that is. But I, you know what I've been thinking a lot about in terms of what we can sort of do is I think our own individual level cap and trade program. So I've been thinking, you know, maybe the thing, some people are never going to give up eating red meat, right? They're going to be like, hey, that's all I like. I'm going to have it 3 times a week. That's going to be my thing, right? Most people, I think, have moved, you know, I feel like a lot of people invested in sustainability are definitely moving away from red meat and other meat products and other animal products. But say you're just that person's like, I love steak so much, I cannot do it. Then you could choose something else. Like you were saying, you had another podcast about clothes, right? Mm-hmm. So what if you say, okay, that's fine, but I'm only going to shop at thrift stores. So you trade one of the things that you really love that you know is sustainably not is not a great idea. But you're like, okay, I'm going to hold on to this one, but I'm going to give up clothes. Or I really, really want to drive my truck, but I'm going to set up this whole rain catchment system on my house or install solar panels. So we recognize, and I think this goes back to that idea of feeling guilty and, you know, that ethical narcissism or virtue signaling, where you're no longer caught up sort of in this paradigm of everybody look at me, I'm so good, but it's in this internal recognition that says, look, these are the things that I feel I can contribute to sustainability. And I think the word contribute is really important too, because I think people hate giving things up. This is our whole notion, along with guilt, our whole notion is accumulation as a culture, right? Like, get the most stuff you can, get the biggest house, get the biggest car, get the greenest grass. And that's, I think, a really hard thing to push against. And if we can find a way to instead say no to everything, but to say yes to some things in that way of contributing, like, I'm going to contribute to sustainability. I'm going to contribute to cutting carbon emissions by buying, you know, a really efficient electric car, or I'm going to invest in solar panels. And that's my contribution. And so when I take a deduction, like, you know, use plastic straws, because I love them, so I don't have plastic straws, but some people love them, that you're saying, I've already made my contribution, I don't have to feel like crap, nor do I have to tell the whole world, ooh, look how fancy I am, I'm so good, because you're not purely good, right? You're a little bit of everything. And I think if people could make those sort of choices for themselves, they wouldn't feel this pressure and this fear I think what happens when they feel pressure and fear and guilt is they end up doing nothing.
Right. No, absolutely. And I'm totally going to use that term of an individual cap and trade program because I think that's such a good way to look at it. I always like to tell people, like, just do what works for you. And maybe you're really, really interested, again, in plastic straws. But if you bring your bag or whatever, like, feel like you're doing your part and contributing and whatever it might be. And by the same token, I feel like what you said about, you know, I have this car that's idling, but I'm doing this rain barrel system or whatever it might be. I think that's also a really good way to look at it because there are a lot of like bigger scale issues in our world that are not single use plastics or, you know, just take a shorter shower. Like there are bigger problems that are not take a shorter shower. So I was hoping that we could kind of talk about maybe like some current events that current events might not be the word, but like some trends that are in the forefront right now. So like the plastic straw situation, or if there's anything that you see people like really investing themselves in that are not really like as big of a problem as they feel.
Yeah, I think so. Like the idea of plastic straws, for example, which is, this is what I would call, and Timothy Morton calls this connection to the object versus the hyper object. So we can take this one idea, which is a plastic straw, which we can all grasp and see and touch and feel and we understand. So that's why everybody can clamor on and start talking about plastic straws, because to imagine the plastic ocean, you know, the big garbage patch the size of Texas in the middle of the ocean is actually too hard to visualize. We can't see it. We can't get to it. We can't touch it. So instead we use these symbolic features like plastic straws, and then everybody gets all up in arms about now it's not fair to people who, you know, can't use utensils and are, you know, people who have disabilities that don't allow them to chew, that they need these straws, you know, and it becomes this, we get in these little tiny fights and everybody collapses and nobody talks about straws anymore because everybody's blown up this huge little thing. But I think it's important to keep in mind those little ideas, because it's similar to giving up a little bit so you can make a lot of progress. So if giving up a straw isn't the thing you need to do, but it's the straw that you can hang on to be the symbol of what the thing you need to do is. But what you really need to do is stop using single-use plastics at all. Or even better, you need to invent, you know, better plastic recycling programs in the United States. You know, especially if we were so dependent on China for recycling our stuff, and we just send it away and you could imagine that it was well taken care of. But just because it's in the middle of the ocean and just because it's somewhere else doesn't mean it doesn't still exist. So I feel like the straw itself, it was just a symbol for this idea that we need to remember, but we can't just focus on the little tiny part of it, right? You can't just buy a Prius and say, okay, I've fixed the planet. But you can remember that, Priuses are cool because they have this ability to remind us all the time of our use of our gasoline usage, of the way that you can invent new systems. What I love most about the Prius is that by braking and stopping, you actually are creating some sort of feedback, right? Positive feedback for your car that actually recharges the battery. To me, when you're driving in a regular car and you have to stop, you recognize that you're putting out more emissions, right? You're actually contributing to carbon. So just because the Prius exists makes us more conscious of other cars that we're driving. And just because we're using plastic straws reminds us that, hey, we're also using a plastic cup. And this is also a plastic fork and knife. And this is also, why am I eating this place that has so much plastic? And I think those kinds of uses of those little tiny objects are really important.
I think that's a great point. Like, I love the idea of just promoting mindfulness. That's what my argument always is with straws. It's not that straws are our biggest problem, but it just connects you to larger issues. And I think that also on the idea of mindfulness and making sure that you're connected to other people and just other parts of the globe, like the idea of China. Like, I would love to go down a dark hole of research on the recycling economy. And once China decides that they're not taking any more plastic, like, how does everyone react? You have to face the fact that it's like now sitting in your country, in your landfills and whatever it might be. And on that topic of recycling, like, what is your kind of response to the recycling economy, because I think something that we talk about a lot with sustainability and something that I personally advocate for a lot is the idea of a low impact lifestyle. So not producing trash if you don't need to, or just being really conscious of your like carbon footprint. Before we started recording, we talked a little bit about The No Impact Man, which is a really great book that I will go ahead and like put in the show notes if anyone's interested in looking at it. But we were talking about just how ridiculous some of his choices were in just reducing his own footprint on the planet. So I said the example that I always think about is he couldn't ride the elevator because that produced emissions. And he worked on the 30-something floor of a skyscraper in New York City. And it was just something really, really ridiculous like that. So kind of promoting the idea of mindfulness without being too extreme.
And, well, I'm just thinking, you know, that book was, I think, so compelling. I think the most important book, or part of that book, or the importance of reading it, is that mindfulness, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you can imagine this person who goes to the grocery store, and I want to be this person, at least this part of him, where he takes his jars and he weighs them, you know, when he gets to Sprouts or wherever he's shopping, and then he goes and fills them up with wheat and, you know, trail mix and granola, everything that he wants to eat. It's not that he's starving himself, but he's not going to use that plastic, right? And the fact that he does this in New York City, which in some ways, you know, it's so much easier to be sustainable in a city because you have there's this infrastructure that rewards sustainability. Everything's much closer together. You don't have to travel so far unless you have to go up 30 flights of stairs, like you said. And, you know, a lot of research has gone into showing that cities themselves produce much less environmental waste than suburbs. And the idea of suburbs, too, I think is part of the difficulty with, or one of the, you know, that sense of accumulation. Let's accumulate more land. Let's keep growing and going out and out and out, and we push further into what we'd call, you know, natural environments. And then you think, okay, well, that's okay. I can obviate my troubles by recycling. And my dream is that everybody has to sit with their garbage for just a month. Like, deal with your garbage for a month. You don't get to recycle. Nobody comes by and picks it up. Nobody gets your glass, gets your, you know, we even in Flagstaff, we have people come by and pick up once you've bagged your pine needles, they'll pick them up and take them to the landfill. So just imagine a month where you had to deal with your own garbage completely. I bet you'd eat a lot less meat because you mm-hmm. don't want to deal with bones or leftover meat, unless you have, I guess, a dog, and then that might get you out of that. You wouldn't want to, you know, you could imagine all the, like, tiny films of plastic that pile up that cover every little jar that, because thanks to the Tylenol scare of 1989, we all have, like, 40 layers of plastic to remove to, you know, to save ourselves from you know, that one-time predator. I sit in the kitchen, in my kitchen, and just imagine, like, the yogurt containers as they pile up, the foil over here. And even I, you know, who look, I try to be as conscientious as possible when I'm shopping, but my kids the other day, they're like, oh, Mom, I need these Go-Go yogurts, you know, those ones that are in the tube that little babies like. But my kids who are 13 and 8 are like, oh, no, these are the only applesauces we like, and they eat these applesauces. And there's so much plastic, and I'm like, oh, I gave in, and I'm like, okay, if it's the only thing you really want today, right? So, again, it's like giving yourself one of those, one out, and you make it up some way by, you know, making your own granola. But that sense of, like, how do you compound mindfulness, or how do you think about each choice you make, is you have to live with your choices. And the problem with shipping things to China or shipping things even to the landfill is we're not really living with them. And I feel like carbon, because it's carbon emissions and climate change are so impossible to see and to touch that we can't feel them. But garbage, I feel like, is similar. It's a good metaphor, at least, even if it's not the exact same thing, right? We're putting out this stuff into the world that is going to be toxic if it's not already toxic. And if you can remember, as you accumulate your plastic cups of your Chobani yogurts, that is similar to the stuff that you're putting out from your tailpipe and from your exhaust, from your natural gas, for your heating your house and your electricity that you use in your house.
Yeah, I like the idea of having everyone live with their choices and live with their garbage. I was in this really cool environmental economics class last semester and spent the whole 4 months or whatever it was, like, on this deep dive of how trash is an economic inefficiency. If we start seeing trash as just a resource or just a pool of resources, like the amount of money that we spend just creating more landfills and covering up that land, and the amount of money we spend on waste management systems and even the recycling economy, like if we can't really do anything with recycled plastics after the second time, are we just feeding into this economy because it makes us feel good? Are we just recycling even though we know most of it is probably going to end up in a landfill at the end of the day? Like, where does that recycling bin go? And just the idea of trash as really like a financial pit. Like, it's just like a money pit, if you think about it. And also on the topic of privilege and trash, living zero waste or living low impact is inherently very privileged because you have to be living somewhere where you have access to bulk stores. You have to be mindful enough of your impact that you can, you know, get reusable produce bags or make sure that you're constantly bringing those bags in your car, have a second set, or just always having jars on hand, whatever it might be. So even though in the long run it saves you money to live as package-free as possible and, you know, shopping at these bulk stores, things of the sort, it is also a very privileged thing. So it's strange to think about, you know, saving money, but you have to have money to save money. Does that make sense?
Correct, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a very interesting kind of like back and forth dynamic. So
it
I was
is,
hoping
yeah.
that we could kind of talk a little bit about some of the realizations that you've had since you've started writing this book, and just some of the things like in our society that we kind of either gloss over or we have these weird parallels with, like I said, with just like saving money, you have to have money, or you can't idle your car, but like being mindful about idling your car, you also have to know that like you have a car and you have the education to know about idling and the impacts of just like sitting in your car and things of the sort.
Absolutely. I mean, so the book, you know, is not only about sustainability. It mm-hmm. really is about trying to figure out how to get along mm-hmm. with other people. And there's a particular chapter in there about trying to get along with my husband at Sam's Club. And, you know, I'm from Salt Lake City, and we had Costco's there, but Flagstaff, we were condemned to only have Sam's Club. And my husband and I went shopping one time, and I don't know, I was on some sort of tear about paper towels. So he puts like a gigantic vat of paper towels in our shopping basket, and they're, you know, they're not recycled. They're, you know, I'm like, there's a pure virgin towels, and I get really uptight and self-righteous and start like, I keep taking them off the cart and he puts them back on, and then we're, you know, now we're just going, it's just like a hot fight. And he's, and then I get a bottle of wine and he's like, well, how much does, you know, how much resources did it take to ship that wine from California to Flagstaff, and how much, you know, what resources went into, you know, burning the sand to make that bottle, and how much is it going to take to recycle that bottle? And here we are though, and this, I mean, I think this relates to both of your questions. One is that, you know, it's this great privilege to be able to fight over these things, that we have the resources to pay for these things, you know, that we get to buy paper towels and wine. You know, it's like, this is, it's on a fundamental level so ridiculous. On the other hand, it does go to show, like, everything, every choice we make is fraught and full of emotional difficulty that is not, I think, going to, and this, you know, goes back to something we were talking about earlier, is not going to make the world actually get to that place where we're all going to have to get together and connect and make some radical choices about how to really stop climate change. Is going to require getting beyond, you know, our husbands or our own pickiness about paper towels. I mean, that's easy. Now we have to talk to people who don't even believe that climate change is happening, or people who refuse to stop using fossil fuels, or we have to, you know, or to other governments who, you know, whose entire economy, Saudi Arabia and Russia, rest on fossil fuels. How are we going to convince them, hey, we should really stop using gasoline? And they'll be like, oh, great, well, we're the richest country in the world, says Saudi Arabia. Why would we stop that? You know, this is where I get hopeless and also hopeful. Foolish is that there we do have this ability to communicate, and I think in desperate situations come together, and I'm afraid that it'll take something pretty desperate to get us to that point where we're like, okay, we've really got to do something here. But I have a question for you. So
okay.
how much do you think technology is going to save us? I feel like I have all these friends who went to Reed College and they're still in Portland and they're doing these great things with recycling. Like they're turning styrofoam into new fuels, right? Or they're growing mushrooms for packaging. So I feel like there's all this cool technology that's out there. Do you think technology is going to be the thing that saves us in the end?
So I think that technology has a lot of power right now. We're living in a really great age where things are progressing very quickly when it comes to climate change solutions. And kind of on the topic of technology is the idea of geoengineering. I think the great thing about geoengineering is that it attracts a lot of people to climate change solutions that would not otherwise be big hippie environmentalists. Right. So if people aren't familiar with geoengineering, so that's just the idea that we could like throw mirrors into space. That's a really hot topic right now for some reason, and that will like reflect some of the sun's radiation and we won't receive as much on Earth. Or putting iron filings into the ocean to increase the albedo, the reflectiveness of the ocean should in theory also help us combat climate change. But the problem with all of these geoengineering solutions is that as soon as you stop, the problem comes right back, full force, whatever it should be at the time, if you continue living your life. So I think technology is great in that it will actually provide us solutions, but not in the shiny way that geoengineering solutions provide us. So I think a place where technology could come in handy is increasing the productivity of solar panels, the efficiency of solar panels. So people don't realize that solar panels industrially could be up to, I want to say, 40% efficient in capturing the sun's radiation, but when they're on your house, it's only about 15%. So that's a huge gap in efficiency and productivity of energy that you could be getting just straight into your home or providing back to the grid or whatever it might be. So I think technology has a lot to do with efficiency when it comes to climate change solutions, but then also just attracting people to solutions in general for like the shinier
Totally. Solutions. That makes sense. Like, because people do like big revolutions, right? And I can imagine there's this technological revolution that changes. But I think along those lines, it not only has to change the situation,
right.
It has to change the way we think about the situation. I think you're right that, yeah, it's possible. Yeah, the mirrors in the ceiling I have a chapter in here about, you know, spraying sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere and stratosphere so it can, you know, reflect that light in that same way. That it's hard to imagine that the solution to such an endemic problem is in the problem that created it, right? So it's hard to imagine a technological solution coming from something that technology brought us to. And I think what you're saying is really smart. Like, it's a matter of efficiency. So this is something I think that is much more fundamental to human, deep human needs or desires, is this ability to do more with what we have around us. And that to me is a much more sustainable, if I'm going to use that word, sustainable model for how to, instead of just accumulating more stuff, right? You're like, here's the stuff I have. Look at all the stuff I can do with it. In that same sense of like, I have all these mushrooms. Look, I can create new packaging. Amazon, listen up, you know? Like this idea that we have stuff around us that is already usable and we've already created it. Let's use it again and again and again. That kind of permanent recycling. But it'll be interesting to see if a technological revolution occurs and if that mental, because usually it does come, you know, I feel like in other scientific revolutions comes along with new ways of thinking and new kinds of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So that would be my dream if we were to use some sort of vast technological ability to capture carbon, right? Which
right.
seems like that one at least seems maybe more permanent than the mirrors or the, you know, the iron filings in the ocean. But even if we come to those solutions that along come this way of like appreciating and understanding the little tiny ways that we can make these adjustments and the ways that the world is so bountiful already that we can use that bounty in a way that is not only consumptive but also productive.
Oh, absolutely. Before I go on, another book that you should definitely read if you're interested in like just more of these efficient solutions is The Quest by Daniel Yergin. Have you read
cool.
that?
I haven't. No.
Yeah, incredible. So his first book was all about oil, like the whole oil industry, and that's something that it's like on my list. I've been meaning to read forever. But The Quest has a chapter on, as a whole, it just goes through different fuel types and what's coming up, and it's broken up in a really easy way that you don't have to like read it as a whole. It's a huge book. It's like 600 pages or something.
Okay, cool.
But it talks about different fuel types, and there's a chapter at the end about efficiency, and it's called, the chapter title is The Fifth Fuel, and it's efficiency. And how we already have all of the solutions, and we have so many great technological advancements in the last, like, 100 years even, that we have progressed so much as a society, and we feel like we have to continue consuming and continue creating and come up with really radical scientific revolutions when it comes to how are we going to save the planet. But people completely forget about efficiency. So going back to the idea of recycling. So the idea of reduce, reuse, recycle, a lot of people don't realize is hierarchy. Before you recycle, you should first think about reducing whatever it is that you're consuming. And then after that, if you really do have to bring home this plastic yogurt container, how can you reuse it so that it's suddenly a Tupperware container that you can use to take your lunch to work or whatever it might be? So the idea of efficiency is something that I'm really passionate about, and I don't think that the idea of sustainability and efficiency are linked often enough. And before we go on, I just wanted to kind of wrap up a little bit and ask about feedback from the book. So what have you kind of heard from people?
So the reception's been, I think, generally really positive. It has, you know, I think people feel really hopeless when they think about sustainability. And one thing I wanted to do with this book is to instill a little bit of humor into it. And so there are funny parts, and I think that goes along with like that sense of recognizing that you're kind of being an idiot at Sam's Club, and that recognizing that you're a little bit hypocritical when you're, you know, yelling about paper towels when you're, you know, buying like a case of wine. No. And you know that you're being that putting yourself sort of on display as well, as opposed to preaching to people and telling them this is what you must do to save the planet. Say, look, this is what I'm doing, and I'm doing kind of badly. Sometimes I succeed, mostly I fail. And allowing the narrator, you know, allowing my narrator here to have some humility and be like, I'm screwing this up as much as anybody, and I am really trying. So, but that attempt to try, I think, is as important, or maybe, you know, I guess this is anti-Yoda-like, but I do think trying is its own kind of effort and its own kind of success, and that you make little tiny adjustments and successes as you make large failures. And so I feel like people got that part of the book. They really did seem to think this is not hopeless. It's funny and it's human, and absorbable in a way that I think a lot of books about, because it, you know, it does try to do as much hardcore science as it can too, talking about geoengineering and carbon sequestering and you know, how much whale poop can you actually, you know, hope will save the planet if we could just grow more whales. It does attempt to draw people in through relationships and humor and those little stories. I did get a review yesterday though that was like, well, in terms of writing, I give it a 5, but in terms of content, I give it 3.5, because we can't all solve everything with plastic straws and Priuses. And I think it's really interesting, because I think they just maybe missed that one thing, and this is, I think, something that and in this conversation we talked a lot about, is it's not that plastic straws are going to save. It's that we have to, by thinking about plastic straws and Priuses, we are being mindful. And I think your word about mindfulness is, it gives me the most kind of hope. So I hope that gets through from the book too.
Awesome. Great. Well, where can everyone find you? Where can everyone find the book?
You can get the book at Brightside Bookshop in Flagstaff, Arizona, and you can get it on at Amazon, of course, and the Ohio State University Press's website as well. And I'm going to be at PALS in January, so the book will be available there. I'm going to do a couple more book tours, one in Napa at the Book Mine and one at Book Soup in Los Angeles, so I'll be around if you want a signed copy. And I think we're actually doing a signing on December 7th at Uptown Pub House at 5:30 if you're in Flagstaff and want to come meet me and Annette McGivney, who wrote Pure Land, a beautiful book as well. So,
oh, how fun. Okay, awesome. I will make sure to have everything down in the show notes below and have a link to Amazon for those listeners who are not in Flagstaff and would like to find it online.
Perfect.
That would be great. Well, thank you so much for hanging out today and meeting, and I'm just so glad that we were able to get together and have this conversation.
Me too. It was such a privilege and so much fun to talk with you. Great. I hope we continue the conversation.
I hope y'all enjoyed that conversation with Nicole. I will go ahead and have her website linked down below, as well as the Amazon link where you could purchase Sustainability, a Love Story. At the end of every episode of Eco Chic lately, we've been answering questions that either get in the DMs or an email. And if you're interested in asking a question to be answered on a future episode of Eco Chic, you can DM me at Laura E. Diaz at Eco Chic Podcast, both of which are always down below, or you can email me laura@lauraediaz.com. And this week's question is actually about composting and stickers. So I have been advertising some Eco Chic stickers that have been getting sent out to so many people, and I'm really excited that people are so excited about putting Eco Chic stickers on their computers and water bottles, and it's really exciting to see all of y'all receiving them and tagging me in your stories. But today's question actually comes from a friend who was asking about the waste aspect of the stickers. So all the stickers go out in these little pink envelopes that I did want to make sure they were recycled paper and just as eco-friendly as possible when it comes to envelopes. But paper is totally compostable. It's an organic material, and it's actually really good for your compost to break up the bacteria in between all of your food waste. So if you are to rip off just the stamp, the upper right-hand corner of the envelope, you can compost the envelope, and you can also compost the note that it comes in. I just write all my notes on cardstock, so that's also a really basic thing that you can throw in your compost. But yeah, you can compost any organic materials. So in addition to food waste and paper, you can also think about yard waste going in your compost, things of the sort. So I hope that's helpful if you're acquiring any trash on my behalf. There's a really great way to dispose of it in a really eco-chic way. With that, I would like to thank everyone for tuning in this week. If you enjoyed this episode of Eco Chic, please go ahead and leave us a like and a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And I hope you have a really good week.